With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving. At your desk. Maybe at the gym. But you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach. And see a rocket launch. Or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I'm your co-host, Menas. Joining me, as ever, is Paul Dennett. Paul, how are you?
Hey, Menas. I'm exhausted. I tried so much to watch the cricket day after day, and last night kind of broke me. I was falling asleep. There were rain delays. I had it on record. I wasn't sure whether I was watching it live or I was watching it on delay or whether I was watching highlights. I think finally I've been broken by it, but it's been a good series.
And we've got Jaleesa Apps back on the show, even after she's been slagging me off on Twitter overnight. Jaleesa, how are you?
I'm really good, Menas. I mean, I'm disappointed you didn't send me today's show notes, but...
Well, you never read them anyway, so.
Oh.
And then our special guest today is the chief cricket writer for the Australian. I was looking back. Pete Lawler hasn't been on the show for 3 months. So, Pete, how are you? Have you been missing cricket?
I'm just relieved that you've invited me back, frankly, Menas. You've got your new mates and you ignore your old ones. Once upon a time, it was every week. Pete, can you be on the show? But no, new friends now, haven't you?
Yeah, moved on, unfortunately.
For you.
I wouldn't have come back, Pete, after that.
Now, in this episode of Cricket Unfiltered, we're going to wrap up the cricket headlines. Then we're going to review The Edge, the documentary about the English cricket team from about 10 years ago. That's what the documentary is on. And then we're going to bring it home with Can't Let It Go. But let's get straight into the headlines, because it's all kicked off overnight. It's been confirmed that the Big Bash will not have an international player draft this summer. And Channel 7 have fired back at their frustration about the standard of the competition. I'll start with you, Pete. This seems to have sort of followed on from the disaster that was the Big Bash last year.
Oh, yeah. It was like another universe, though, wasn't it, what we were dealing with last year, or what the Big Bash was dealing with. And whether or not it was a disaster or just another season of declining returns, they have got themselves in a very awkward position, haven't they, CA? I think, you know, everybody will say everybody kind of agreed that the Big Bash needed international players and it needed Australian stars, and probably it needed to be across a shorter time period. But I guess what? No international players, no Australian stars, and it's across a longer time period. But if you have had an excuse, you probably get an excuse in an environment like this.
What about the quality of players that are on display? If you could potentially have 20, 30, 40 of Australia's best players in bubbles around the country playing international cricket, you're going to suck all the, well, not all, but most of the talent out of the Big Bash.
So there's going to be no international draft, but there's still going to be international players, aren't there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's not that bad. I think that was would have been a fun gimmick, but I think that you can postpone that for 1 year without too much trouble.
To be fair to James Warburton, and that's who we're talking about today, the head of Seven West Media, who's complained about the dealings with Cricket Australia and probably indicated, and it's no surprise to anyone, that they may be looking to renegotiate their deal, because every broadcaster has renegotiated their deal with a sport. But what he's expressing frustration at the negotiations, at the level of dealing with Cricket Australia. He hasn't pointed, well, as far as I know, or have you seen more than me? Because this is a breaking story as we speak, but he seems to be saying it's been very difficult to deal with them, that, you know, that there's no certainty around the summer. The AFL were much easier to deal with.
Yeah, I think Cricket Australia are in a tough spot, though, because the AFL, they run the competition. There's no international AFL. They just work out their competition and go with it, whereas Cricket Australia has to wait for the BCCI to organise their competitions, and it's like a domino effect.
You can understand as a broadcaster why you'd be frustrated, because all your advertising, there's people's jobs that rely on all that advertising, and you can't really settle that until you know what. So I totally understand his frustration.
Yeah. Look, I reckon the biggest problem that cricket's had, that no sport has had, is, or Australian cricket is, it actually hasn't had to play games. Like, for all the football codes actually had to, like, use all their energy to get out there and put the sport on. And look at Aussie Rules only got around to sacking its executives 2 days ago. But it's just been jelly wrestling at Cricket Australia, isn't it? Because they've got nothing else to do. So, you know, everyone's poking each other in the eye and or whatever else is going on, because they haven't had that sort of immediate sort of demand of putting on sport. They've occupied themselves with, well, what about this? What about that? And so it's just turned into a sort of mudslinging exercise in a way.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting the way this plays out in the lead up to the Big Bash season. The next headline is the Aussie team, speaking of getting back into action, they will be taking on the old enemy in 6 matches in England starting early next month. 3 T20s, 3 ODIs. It's all hub talk. That's what everyone's talking about. It's bubble and hub talk for the cricketers, because they're all going into isolation for possibly months now.
Yeah, it was funny to Steve Smith did a media opportunity at the airport on Sunday, which Peter was also at. It was funny to
Were you there, Celeste? I didn't see you.
Oh, well, I thought you might not have seen me.
Are you aware? No. It's hard to recognise people in a mask, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. But it was interesting. The one thing that I got out of that was Steve Smith saying he'll miss the crowd. He'll miss the English crowd. I was like, are you okay, Steve? Do you remember how brutal they are?
Well, that was the same Steve Smith who said he didn't hear the English crowd in last year's Ashes, wasn't it?
And this time he said that he needs them to spur him on.
Better stick to the script, Steve. Interesting experience. I was just looking. I just got sent some pictures and some footage, because they've landed in Derby, and there's the kits have come off the bus, and so these people who look like, you know, they're fighting Ebola, which I guess they are in a way, come out and they're spraying their bags with all this stuff and going through all their things, and it's going to be a very interesting experience for them.
Have you heard from the players, Pete? Are they up for it? Does anyone have any reservations about going over there?
No. I think they're all very keen. I think the only reservations was around what happened when they got back and whether they'd be able to train, and, you know, and that was going to have more impact on, you know, more on the bowler's side of things than the batsman's side of things. But hey, if you had a chance to get on a plane and go and play cricket after the last few months, you'd be busting a gut, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You're in the wrong game if you don't want to play cricket right now.
It would have been the most peaceful check-in that they've ever had, because there was no one there to bother them.
Well, you were there.
I was, well, that's true. It wasn't that peaceful.
Justin Langer said in the lead up to leaving for England that of the 21 squad that they're taking over, not everyone will be guaranteed a game. So you could have a lot of these players like Philippi and Meredith just being kind of net bowlers or there for the practice. So I don't think that's the problem, taking some young players over there for experience.
No, no problem at all. What are they going to be doing if sitting at home ports? I mean, going through state, a sort of half-assed state training. That's all that's going on at the moment. So, yeah, it's a big vibe around Felipe. Is it? How do you pronounce it? I say Felipe. What do you say, Menon?
I say Felipe.
You say Felipe? Okay, just Felipe today.
Yeah. I say Felipe because I think that's what they I think he himself says Felipe, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But what would he know, mate?
He wouldn't know. He wouldn't know.
He's cricketer. Yeah. Jaleesa works for television, and I work for a newspaper.
We never get anything wrong.
You could argue that you get your surname wrong, Pete. A lot of people would say Layla for you.
Yeah, we'll decide how the surname's pronounced. And there's a buzz around him. I think that people see a lot of upside to him as a potential batsman and a keeper, I think. So he might be a bit of a threat to Kerry on the tour, do you reckon? No, joking.
Well, I did think maybe the fact that they've taken the vice captaincy away from Kerry does kind of open the door now for a bit of a battle for not only who'll get the white ball spot, but, you know, when Tim Payne bows out in the next couple of years, that the test spot's open.
To me, it seems as though they're Philippi is there to play, I reckon. Maybe Meredith and Sam's might be there to make up the numbers more, but I think they have Philippi in their long-term plan for World Cups.
I reckon you're right too. I think he's certainly a long-term option.
Now, last week we had Aaron Finch on the podcast and I wasn't able to get the story out of him because I'm not the professional that Jared Waitley is, but Waitley was able to get out of him that Finch is going to retire at the end of the 2023 World Cup if he makes it. And my question to all of you is, will Finch make it?
Well, yes, he will. Might as well be definitive. I think there's every chance he will, and I think it's a smart thing for him to say because I think as soon as that 2023 World Cup is over, then they'd want to move him on because he'd be 40 by the 2027 World Cup and they moved on Taylor and Waugh and Ponting. So I think he's every chance of making it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but it makes sense. I agree with Paul. It's a good idea. He's a very good cricketer and he's got some years left in him. Yeah, why not?
Great leader. He's really been immense in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's the untold story in a way. I mean, Tim Payne's got a lot of the credit, and rightly so, for that sort of re-establishing the reputation of the Australian cricket team. But I think Finchie's done a brilliant job too. You know, he's another case of the right man in the right place at the right time for Australian cricket. Just got a calm head and just a lovely bloke, which is unusual.
That's the thing. He presents a statesman-like appearance to the media, possibly that hasn't been the case since Mark Taylor. Not saying the others weren't nice, but he is very affable, which he's tough on the field, but he's affable to the media, which I think is a really nice combination.
Yeah, he was very nice on the podcast last week. And he could have a momentous tour of England because he just needs 118 runs to make 5,000 ODI runs and 11 runs to make 2,000 T20 runs. So he could hit some illustrious groups. The female team is in action next month, taking on New Zealand. Australia will play 3 ODIs and 3 T20s. The squad's been announced. No big news there. Elise Perry's back from injury. I'm really glad to see Maitland Brown from the Renegades picked in the squad. She's very funny. And the Australian women's team have a chance to equal the world record of Ricky Ponting's team and win 19 ODIs in a row. Incredible. What a record.
That is good news. I thought the biggest news in women's cricket this week was Lisa Stelaeker.
Oh, you stole my can't let it go.
What have I done?
Yeah, Lisa Stelaeker's been admitted to the ICC Hall of Fame. What an achievement.
She's got the framed cap. She's got the pin. Unfortunately, she misses out on the all expenses business class tickets to the event, because I think she would have taken her dad over and said thank you to him. But great cricketer, great woman, over 100 ODIs, didn't she? 2,000 runs. How many wickets did she take? Was it about 100? It's pretty close to 150, 146, I reckon.
Yeah.
Outstanding person. And, of course, director on the Chapel Foundation, organised our sleep out 2 weeks ago. She runs that. She's a great person.
I agree. And she was the first woman to achieve the ODI double of 1,000 runs and 100 wickets. And she's such a lovely person. I remember she came into my cafe the first time and I asked her onto the podcast and she was so lovely. She came in and did the podcast many years ago. And it's great to see her being rewarded for the big contribution she's given to cricket.
She was the first ever guest on the podcast, wasn't she?
The first ever guest that had played international cricket.
Exactly, yeah.
What happens? How does that work, man? Do you get like a free piece of banana bread or something if you agree to go on the podcast?
Definitely. Coffee, banana bread.
I didn't.
Well, you didn't read the notes. I'm like. Now, the next headline and another popular appointment, Jason Gillespie has been made coach of South Australia. I think this is a wonderful appointment. I think Gillespie is one of the best coaches in the world and he should be in our local game. So I think this is can only be good for South Australian cricket.
Couldn't agree more. Fantastic guy. I was lucky enough to sort of catch his career when I was a young cricket writer and always a bubbly, you know, a decent person, a decent bloke, wonderful cricketer. And really proved himself as a coach. And I reckon the mark of him as a coach is the reaction of the English media, who seem to hold Australians in contempt for some reason I don't understand. That it was sort of universal praise for Dizzy, who's pulling out of his contract over there a year early, I think, or 6 months, is it, to come back. Good guy. They need him over there, don't they? They finished last three years in a row. They finished on the bottom of the shield table.
Mm. Yeah, they haven't won since 1996, I think.
Was that the last time the Adelaide Crows won a footy game too? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
How did we get to AFL with this?
I love that you did that, Pete, because I always say something about another sport on this podcast and Menes gets so mad at me.
How good was Jarman, Pete, in those late 90s when the Crows won? Best of all. Yeah, it was fantastic, wasn't it?
They were a jump team back then, weren't they?
I don't know, guys. I was in nappies, so.
One thing about Jason Gillespie is the players love him that he works with. He must be doing something right. The next appointment to be made is the Victorian coach. Any headline there, Pete? Do you have the news? Is it Rogers or Hodge?
No, that's all I know. It's either Rogers or Hodge. And no, if you can, I can't read the mind of Victorian cricket at the moment. Be interesting to see which way they go. Which way would you go, Menes, on that one?
That's a tough one. Probably Rogers because he's been.
Yeah.
There's not much between those two, I would think.
No. It'll be an it's only a short term. I think they're talking about a short term position. Anyway, I wonder what Cameron White will do because he's given up on all cricket now, hasn't he? And he had been in, I think he was interested in that position, but only if it was a shorter term prospect.
Yeah, I think he's taken his name out of the hat for that. So
he has, yeah. So they must be talking about a 2-year contract. But no, last week they hadn't made up their mind last time I looked into it.
The next headline is the Caribbean Premier League has started and I've been loving it. I've been on Sunday. I watched 2 Caribbean Premier League games back to back on delay. Chris Green, the Sydney Thunder spinner, helped his team, the Guyana Amazon Warriors, defend the lowest total in CPL history, keeping Jamaica to 104 for 7 and defending 118. Chris Lynn's over there. He hasn't got going yet, but I'm thrilled that we've got some T20 cricket going.
Ben Dunk, if you've got Ben Dunk, he's there as well.
Yep.
I don't know if
Farwad Ahmed.
Farwad's there as well. Yep. Simon Helmut was going, but I'm not sure that he got there, the coach, the Victorian coach.
Have you been watching it, Paul?
I watched a little bit of it the other night. I wasn't into it, though, because, I don't know, it takes me a little bit of time maybe when there's no crowd to really get into it. I'll give it another go. But it was on the back of till 3 a.m. watching the test match at the Oval. And at Southampton, so I should have gone to bed, but I tried to watch it. It was just too much.
2020 is one of those things that is really affected by the crowd. Like a lot of other sports, you can watch and you really you notice that there's no crowd at the start, even boxing and UFC, you notice there's no crowd at the start, but then by the time you start watching, you're right into it. But 2020 is one of those funny ones where it does rely so much on atmosphere.
Yeah, I disagree. I get what you're saying, but I've just noticed that we are so conditioned to watching cricket with no crowds, whether it's the Shield or tests in different parts of the world, that just seeing the players going in and getting the ball from the stands is not a big thing for me anymore.
I agree when it's tests and Shield, but 2020, I don't. I think it's a really different feel. It'd be interesting to see the Big Bash if you can't have crowds, what it'll feel like.
Well, yeah, I think it'll be much like the CPL. I hope that they do better noise with the sound effects in Australia, because the CPL, it just seems to have this buzz of the crowd the whole time, but there's no sort of, you know, in the AFL and the NRL, they're working with the sound effects, whereas CPL just seems pretty standard.
Yeah, well, there's a company that do all that both 7 and 9 use. I don't know if they use the same company, but they bring the sound up, take it down, and they're very specialised in it. So it pays dividends because it makes it sound exciting.
Well, yeah, adds atmosphere. And the last cricket headline, and I've saved it to last, because the problem with this COVID thing, one of the problems is having to talk about English cricket too much. So it's the England v Pakistan third test. Zach Crawley's made, what did he make, 267. Paul, have you got some stats you want to read out?
Well, he threw it away. I mean, he should have got 300. He's had a poor outing, the kid. He got stumped jumping down the wicket to a ball a metre wide of leg stump from Asad Shafiq. Bradman wouldn't have got out that way. the stats, you put the stats here, Menas, and I just fell in love with them, that it was the fifth highest wicket partnership in Test cricket history. And so just going through them all, the highest, Barnes and Bradman, 405 in 1946. Trivia question, what did they score?
Right, this is easy. This is a free hit.
We'll go. Do it then.
234 each.
Well done. Yep.
And Sid Barnes got out on 234, so he would be remembered with Bradman.
Yeah, I think he denied it for a while, then came clean later on that he did it deliberately. Warren Blewett. Jaleesa, do you remember that? 1997. How old were you?
I was 6.
That was they batted the entire day. They batted the entire day together. And then, of course, Laxman and Dravid, 376. One of the more nightmarish things I've ever seen. Fantastic partnership, but destroyed Australia.
So I thought Crawley looked fantastic, and he has a bit of Kevin Peterson about him. He's so tall, he can just put that foot down the wicket and swing across the line. I don't know, Pete, what did you think of him? Did you see him bat?
Yeah, I watched him bat. I thought it was pretty good. I didn't think the bowling was all that great to him, but I don't want to take anything away. That was a fantastic innings, and good luck to the guy. And it's been really interesting cricket over there, hasn't it? You kind of see the teams, the visiting teams, they burst out of the blocks, but then they run out of puff really quickly. And it's only a small sample size, but I wonder if it is the circumstances that they're existing in over there. Certainly Jason Holder blamed that, didn't he, at the end of the third test, saying that life in that bubble really gets to you when you're playing test cricket. Like you wake up and you open the curtains and you can see the cricket pitch. It'd be like you sleeping next to the coffee machine in a cafe, you know, or sleeping next to the photocopier at work.
We used to record many podcasts in my bedroom, so you used to sleep in the studio.
There's no doubt one thing they've got to get under control is the light, because even on day three, I don't know why the umpires didn't take them off in that. Was it day three, that final session?
Yeah.
Where the light was just, I don't know if they were, I don't know. I wonder if it's a mentality of, because we'd missed so much of this series already, that they were feeling under pressure to keep it going. But, you know, you had them out there saying it was dangerous. You can't have it dangerous.
It was really interesting that happened, because they copped so much spray over light and rain and, you know, not playing in the second test. So if they did overcompensate in the third test, you'd understand it. But then to have, you know, those three catches dropped, and was it Dom Bess who said that?
Yeah, it was Dom Bess, yeah.
Couldn't see the ball. He said if it was coming straight at me, I'd have been, I don't know what I would have done. So it highlights it. It is a safety issue, isn't it? They need to be aware of that. They have bad lights over there. They have terrible lights over there. I think there's still sort of gas-fired lights or something, you know. Probably were installed around the Dickens era. But Australian lights are much stronger because our, you know, coal burns very brightly.
Well, they're saying LED lights.
They cop so much for when they do stop play, and I think people don't understand that when it looks – what the way it looks on TV, the way it looks in the stand is so different to how it looks down in the ground. And you know, I hope they didn't overcompensate, because you got to be stronger than that. You can't have it dangerous.
The best example of that was back in the 2007 World Cup final, where the stump cam didn't have the ability to fix the light. And so you'd see the coverage from the normal cameras, and it looked okay. And then they showed it from stump cam, and it was pitch black. It was absolutely unbelievable. Hey, one for you, Pete. The second T20 that Australia's playing against England on the Sunday, I've got a theory that it could go down as the most watched game, one of the most watched games in the history of cricket in England, because it's going to be, as far as I'm aware, the second game on free-to-air TV since it went behind the paywall. They've got one of the T20s between England and Pakistan is going to be on BBC One, and then this one between Australia and England on BBC One. So with no Premier League on and everyone with a higher appetite for sport, could be one of the most significant games in terms of cricket's popularity in England for a long time.
Gee, that's a great point, Paul. So that would be the first time that it's Australia played England on air since 2005 on free-to-air.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the first time on the BBC since 99, to my understanding.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a rotten situation, isn't it? They really undid themselves by selling. Like, they lost all that momentum from 2005 with that broadcast deal. But yeah, do you reckon? I reckon the Pakistan game would get a fair buy-in too. There'd be a lot of subcontinental people watching that. Yeah, you know?
For sure.
A lot of Indians watching it, hoping that Pakistan would lose.
So they'll be very reluctant to come off a bad light during those games.
Well, I hope it
doesn't. Are they in Manchester or South? They're in Southampton, aren't they?
Yeah, it's with the white ball, so they should be okay. But I think that the T20s are in Southampton.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that is the cricket headlines brought to you by Piccolo Podcast. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. What's your schedule now? You can't travel and follow the cricket. What's your plan?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just hanging around waiting for people to invite me on podcasts and things. I really, it's strange, isn't it? I can't remember spending a winter at home either with you. And I don't know what I'm going to be doing in the summer. So I'm just sitting here walking the dog and talking on podcasts and typing for the newspaper. So, fingers crossed we'll be on the road for the summer, but there's a very good chance that we won't be.
Mm. Yeah, well, that'd be such a shame. Well, Pete, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Always.
Thanks, Pete.
Bye.
Thanks, Pete. See you.
See you, Jaleesa.
That was the cricket headlines. Thank you to Peter Lawler for joining us. And we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back to review The Edge, the documentary about the English cricket team. Mm.
So now you know that your local Blooms the Chemist does this free medication packing service that helps you take the right dose on time every time. But what happens if you don't? What happens if you double up or eat certain foods? What does your medication even do? So many questions. Just as well, the team at Blooms the Chemist has so many answers. To learn more about the medications you take, call into your local Blooms the Chemist. Free local home delivery is available if you can't get out. Blooms the Chemist. Share good health.
You're listening to the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I'm Menes. I'm with Paul Dennett and Jaleesa Apps. And I watched on Amazon Prime the documentary The Edge about the English cricket team a couple of weeks ago, and I was so excited about it. I just loved it so much. I thought I'd share it with my podcasting colleagues and we could talk about it on this show, and we're going to give it our marks out of 10 at the end. But basically, the documentary is about the English cricket team from early 2009 till basically early 2014, when they got hammered in the Ashes here 5-0, and it's about their rise and fall. And I'll start with you, Paul. What did you think of it?
Well, I actually quite liked it. I kind of, we'll get to Jaleesa's reaction, but I knew in advance that Jaleesa wasn't such a fan. And I thought, I really want to dislike it because I wanted to be able to, you know, team up with Jaleesa and gang up on you. But regrettably, I actually did quite like it a lot. I thoroughly enjoyed it, to be quite honest, yeah.
So, Jaleesa, you weren't a fan. Would you like
I want to know what Paul liked about it because I don't know.
Well, I've got a whole list here I can go through.
No, but I just want to know what Paul liked about it.
Okay, thank you.
What I liked is, firstly, that it almost took the attitude that they wanted it to be shown to a wide audience in England of sports fans, not just cricket fans. And I think they probably thought a lot of people in England think cricket is boring or posh or not very tough. So they went very hard the other way and made it seem as edgy and tough and ruthless and brutal as possible. And they emphasised how big a sport it is in various parts of the world. And then I just think they told the story well. And I remember watching all of the iterations that they went through. I thought it was in 2010-11, they had probably one of their greatest sides ever. For it to have fallen apart so badly 4 years later and so many players to be going through so many different things, and there was the Kevin Peterson saga as well. I just found it really gripping and interesting, and, you know, ultimately it was about cricket, so I was always kind of predisposed to like it as well.
Fair enough.
Well, run through some of the things you didn't like about it.
Me or Paul?
You. Go on.
Oh, okay.
We've been waiting all night for this.
Okay.
We can release this as a 1 hour extra supplement as well.
Yeah. You're going to have to probably cut this down. I absolutely hated it. And there was a few reasons why I hated it. I think the first reason is because I had really high expectations for it, which is never good. So I was really excited to watch this. I think I watch a lot of documentaries on everything, mostly murder. But and there's a lot of murder happening in my documentary. So I watch some weird documentaries. The only things I actually watch are sport and documentaries and news. I don't really get into things that aren't real. So I had a huge expectation for this. Two of the documentaries that I absolutely love in the sporting world are The Last Dance and The Test. So if you haven't seen The Test, is obviously about the Australian cricket team. If you haven't seen that, go and watch it immediately. It's amazing. The second one that I love is The Last Dance, which goes through Jordan and
You and everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. So I
way saw overrated. Everyone that was that. Way overrated.
That is another podcast. But anyway, so I had really high expectations for this. There are a few things I didn't like about it. While I was watching it, I wasn't sure what it was. I was like, hang on, what is this? And halfway through, I was like, oh, it's a story about their mental health. I guess that's what I took from it. If you're going to tell a mental health story, you need to tell it really, really well, because it's such a important topic. And I felt like this was a story that was told. It was a good story told so badly. And there were a couple of reasons I thought it was told so badly. It was, first of all, it didn't have vision. It was a newspaper yarn. So often we get stories in our newsroom and you go, God, that's a good story, but there's no pictures. So it doesn't work for TV. It works for the newspaper. And I felt like this was a newspaper feature jammed into a documentary. And they actually, because they didn't film anything from that time, or at least they didn't source any pictures.
But see, Lisa, I'll just jump in here. I think that's one of the reasons it was better in some ways than The Test, because the players, because of the passage of time, were able to be a bit more honest, a bit more reflective, and had sort of thought about what happened around that period. Whereas The Test, I felt you learnt a lot, but it wasn't the players, you know, reflecting, it was just the vision.
But visually, this is a visual medium, and visually I thought it was terrible. Visually, I thought it was terrible because you had all these really staged cinematic shots of like Trot drowning underwater. I was like, I'm sorry, am I watching poor man's Baz Luhrmann? Like, what am I watching? Like these weird shots of like him in a field and everything. I'm like, I'm sorry, this is like visual cliches all over the shop. I
thought that was effective.
And some of it I found like the mental health discussion wasn't delved into or explained, which in the Michael Jordan documentary, it talked about all the pressure that he was under and why he walked away. And it showed all the media and the things that the media were saying. I don't feel like this showed actually what the amount of pressure that they were under and why they were having mental health issues. It just went, they were having mental health issues, but let's not explain any context to that. I mean, it lost me on so many points.
Clearly.
It was very slow, and I felt like for such an important documentary and something that could have been so good, I was so disappointed.
I think that's interesting around the point around the mental health, because they gave the signs of how pressurized cricket is, but what they didn't go into is why there was all that fracturing amongst the team. It was sort of like... Why was Peterson so angry with them? They referred briefly to that Twitter account, the Kevin Peterson genius Twitter account that had been set up that offended him so much, and they had Broad saying that he wasn't involved. They needed to delve into that a little bit more, I think, to really do that justice. It was almost like the team was going great, and then all of a sudden they weren't, and it was like, well, you've got to give us more information as to why that is. So
yes. I think that's
the point you raised there.
Well, I think they did, because they focused on the fact that Flower was so intense, he was so compelled to win, that pressure on the team eventually forced the cracks, and it was too much for them, that the will to win above everything eventually was what brought them down. So I've got a whole list of things that are good about it I want to read out. So the first one was, it was well narrated by Toby Jones. I thought the narrator was excellent.
I can agree with that.
I really liked the little snippets of history, cricket history they put in for a casual fan, like why England and Australia hate each other so much in the Ashes, and those little bits of filmmaking I thought were excellent if you were a casual fan. The music was fantastic. Well, really well scored. I think Andy Flower was such a compelling character because we saw him then obviously being a really tough sort of general type coach that pushed his team to extremes. And then sort of 10 years later, he reflects on that and thinks maybe he, you know, pushed them too hard and he didn't actually coach the individual person as much as he coached the cricketer. So I thought he was a compelling character. Kevin Peterson's fascinating. I agree. Anderson jogging on the beach was a little much. I didn't enjoy some of that stuff.
In the field, drowning underwater.
Then there was some of the stuff about the cricket. Like, I didn't realise David Saker had such a big influence on the 2010-11 tour. You know, I thought the insights into Trott and Pryor were really good. Both guys who, didn't hold a lot of affection for before this documentary, but they were both pretty raw and honest on camera, so I thought that was very compelling. And then there was the cricket as well. Like you forget that the 2009 Ashes gets lost between after the 2005 Ashes, but that was actually a brilliant series. The 2010-11 Ashes in Australia, the MCG stuff I hated, not because it was poorly made, but because that was the worst day of my life. So, So I found it really, really powerful. I liked the way it was told. I liked the fact that they took some creative risks, because if you're a casual fan, you need those hooks to keep you watching. So I thought it was a great insight into the characters. I thought they were all pretty raw and honest. So I had no complaints about it at all.
I just thought that visually it was done just terribly. I just thought the sequence, the one that killed me was the underwater sequence that just went on and on and on. And I was like, okay, this is so obvious. You have no vision to film this documentary. So you've just shot this. You've put a lot of production value into shooting this underwater sequence. And I just felt it so cliche. I actually, the funny thing about it is, for something I was begging to end because I just was struggling so hard to get through it, I actually think it would have been done better as a 5-part series or a 6 or 7-part series, because I just don't think it went into anything enough for me. It just glazed over. I really want to know, like, why did everyone hate Kevin Peterson and the text message? And I like go into depth about that and then show all the media pressure they were under and what people were saying about them and actually what was happening on the field. And I just felt like everything got glazed over, and there were bits in it. There is this perception out there generally that athletes get paid all this money, which they do, they get paid millions, so they should not feel pressure, or they shouldn't have mental health problems. They shouldn't have all these things that normal people have because they've got heaps of money. And it's such a terrible misconception that's out there. And I actually felt like at times this film did nothing to help that, because it didn't explain why they get these problems and how the rest of us don't deal with everything publicly like they do. And so I think they could have explained that a lot better. Like the one moment in it that just I was like, oh my God, what am I watching, was when Monty Panesar was talking about how hard it was to have an that he had an addiction, and it was an eating addiction, that he was eating too much room service. I was like, okay, well, we're all smashing a packet of Tim Tams of an Arvo. Like, I don't know. I was just like, all right. But also there was actually, that didn't seem serious enough to me. Mm. Kind of, you it didn't highlight
it.
The real.
You just hated it. Full stop. You hated the whole thing.
Yeah. I hated it.
The funny thing about it for me was my personal emotions were the opposite to the documentary. So as the England team is on the rise, I'm getting more and more depressed, because the 2009 Ashes, I was in London for that final test, and I was going to go to the day after Australia collapsed in their first innings. So when Broad ripped through us, my heart broke then and now. And then the 2010-11 Ashes, I went to the MCG Boxing Day test, and it was horrific. So as the documentary is getting happier, I'm feeling worse. And then at the end, when you've got Mitchell Johnson coming in, you know, destroying the Poms, making Trot basically disintegrate on the field, I was feeling cock-a-hoop. So for me, it ended really well. I think that's one of the reasons I'm so positive about it, because at the end, Australia have just floored England again. For me, it was a feel-good story.
One thing as well that I don't mind that they did this, but they did exaggerate the rivalry. And then, you know, they had Saker saying that cricket's the number one sport in Australia. It's not. They had the talk of the MCG on Boxing Day being the most cauldron-like atmosphere in the world. It's not. It's a lovely atmosphere, but Edgbaston is more intimidating. Plus, there's always about 20 or 30,000 from the Barmy Army there. They didn't mention the 2013 Ashes at all, because it didn't sort of suit their narrative of the team on decline. And they said it would be the first time in history that England would be the number one side. They didn't point out that the rankings officially haven't been around all that long. They're making it seem like in 140 years, England have been the best side in the world. But I can forgive them for all those things, because they were trying to get the non-cricketing fan from England to get interested in it. And I think that I forgive them for some of those things, and some of their kind of, as you point out to Jaleesa, some of their sort of cliche techniques. They maybe did that with that in mind.
The only thing, Paul, I'll pick you up on there is about the sort of hostile atmosphere at the MCG. I think the English players probably get a lot more abuse than we realise. Not whether that's more than Edgbaston or not, but, you know, I could totally see where they're coming from, that there's probably, you know, a few thousand drunk Aussies in particular that'll just be yelling shit at them all day.
Yeah, but I put it this way. If you're an England cricket fan and you've been used to going to England cricket games and football games, and you come out to the MCG thinking, oh, wow, this is going to be the biggest atmosphere I've ever seen, you'll be like, oh, there are 90,000 people here, but it's a bit quiet. That's what Mohit Ali said, that when he was out here, he was saying how quiet the crowds were. And everyone pointed out, well, the crowds are much bigger here. But I think I'm missing the point that he was saying that they just don't get behind them in the same way. Sure, you're going to cop a bit of abuse from Bay 13, although these days you probably get kicked out quite quickly. But Strauss also talking about how you could see Australians streaming out on day one. And they overlaid that with footage of what I think was probably day four, when the crowd was empty anyway. So a few little slightly misleading things they did there, but I can forgive them for that.
I always find the Boxing Day test, every time I've been to the Boxing Day test, I don't know, maybe it's who I go with, it's a party atmosphere. No one's like that abusive.
I think there's always a few blokes that'll have a crack at the Poms if they're nearby. All right, now it's rating time. Marks out of 10 for The Edge. Well, I can't remember my mark for the test. Was it 6 out of 10?
Yeah, you'd gone on and on every episode how wonderful it was. Here it was the best thing ever. And then you gave it 6 out of 10. And we had a go at you for not understanding the concept of numbers, I think.
I wasn't here when you rated this, because I was during that COVID. You gave it 6 out of 10?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you okay?
I am okay. So what do you want to give your marks, Jaleesa, for the test and The Edge?
Yes. So the test, it's one of the best sporting documentaries I've seen of all time. So I'm going to go, you can never get 10, so it's a 9.
Okay. And The Edge?
Loved The Test. Thought it was fantastic. The difference between The Test and The Edge is how they had so much behind-the-scenes footage, which is exactly what this missed. The Edge, I give 1 out of 10.
1 out of 10?
And you know what? It would have been a 0 out of 10, except thank you, Mitchell Johnson. That was the footage that saved it for me. I was like, oh, yes, watching Mitchell Johnson. Yep, that'll save this documentary. It wasn't much of it. I liked how they were throwing balls at Mitchell Johnson, a picture of Mitchell Johnson's head in the boot camp too. That was quite funny.
Yeah.
And the other part I really liked about it is where they were talking about lifting the trophy and all they wanted to do, and it was like the little replica from the
little shop.
Yeah, from the shop. So that earned 1 star.
Again.
One out of 10. That's how numbers work. One out of 10.
Graham Swan being a bit disingenuous. He must have known they were going to give him the real ashes.
I don't know if they would.
Paul, what's your mark?
So focused on what they're doing that I don't know if they know.
I was going to give it 8, and then after hearing Jaleesa, I probably were going to drop it down to 5, but then Menas, you brought me back up. I might give it a 7.
Okay. It's good to know you're so easily swayed by the opinions around you.
I've got new nicknames for us. Mad Menas, Angry Apsy, and Polite Paul.
I'm going 8 out of 10 for it.
You liked it better than The Test.
Yep, absolutely. I thought it was terrific. I liked the risks they took. I liked the fact that if you're just someone that doesn't like cricket, you watch it and you know more about cricket. I think it was terrific.
See, I think you actually have to know a lot about the backstory about, like, especially the Strauss-Peterson thing. I think you actually needed a lot of assumed knowledge there.
I'm not sure about that.
I want to hear what everyone else thinks. Can everyone tweet
us? Okay, so Diddly Squat tweeted in. He says, in fact, it was quite sobering to realise just how many of the team really struggled mentally, I found. All in all, I thought the documentary was a fascinating look into the pressure on a team striving to perform at the highest level over an extended period of time. Robert Fairhead, your mate Apsy, TV, I'm struggling with it. I don't think the production is as good as The Test. Oh, mind you, the mental health part of the doco is good. I'm glad they talked about it as you guys have on your podcast. So that summed up
my experience for me, because I was like hating it. Oh, it's a mental health story. It seems like that's what happened with Robert too. Halfway through, you're like, right, this has actually got some meat to it.
Yeah, well, I loved it. All right, so that was our review of The Edge. I want to review like Cricket Fever, the documentary about the Mumbai Indians one day. Have you both seen it?
Nope.
I haven't seen it. I've heard it was good, but I haven't seen it.
Well, both of you should watch it on Netflix. And I think it's like 8 or 10 episodes, so it would be you'd have to sort of binge it over a couple of weeks. All right, let's move on to viewer mail. And this is an interesting one. We've got a message from our American listener, one of our American listeners, Max Arrow.
Love America.
Now, Ricky Ponting last week has said he won't tolerate Ravi Ashwin using the man cad in the IPL, and he's told his team man cads are off the table. And this is an interesting one because this is what Max Harris has to say. G'day, Menas. Loved the podcast and became hooked on cricket after seeing India and the Aussies at the SCG a couple of years ago. As a big baseball fan like yourself, I'm confused as to why running out the non-striker is so reviled by so many people in cricket. In baseball, nobody thinks that picking off a runner is an illegitimate way to make an out. It is understood that by leaving his base, that's a risk he takes and his fair game. And he goes on a bit more, but great message there from Max Harris. I mean, he puts it really logically. Why is there an issue about man cads?
I think, Max, it's because historically, most of the time, the non-striker hasn't been looking to really gain an advantage. They've been generally just walking a couple of steps after the ball has left the bowler's hand. And when they've been man-catted more often than not, it's kind of just been a feeling like, oh, okay. It's like you're getting pulled up for getting, like I do to people, for having the incorrect grammar. It's like someone says 8 items or less, and you go, no, it's 8 items or fewer. And it's like, okay, mate, good on you. It's not as though there's a real skill in it that the non-striker generally has been trying to to steal a match. You know, if the non-striker was 10 metres wide and then there was another set of stumps that you could throw down like in baseball, then I think it would be a completely legitimate thing. But I think that that's the sort of feeling. And I think that Ponting's doing the right thing, not because I think there's anything wrong with man-catting in this era. I just think he doesn't want the hassle. You know, he knows that if there's a run out at the non-striker's end, it's going to be world headlines, and Ponting just doesn't want to have to deal with that. And I'd be the same.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Ponting's just taking the conservative approach there. Like, you know, why deal with the drama? So I totally agree. But I have actually no problem with man-catting. I think that sometimes I'm watching, when I do watch cricket, again, it's probably more recent times, you see the non-striker is so far out now, and you do think, oh gosh, you just, you know, I think it's all fair in love and cricket, but it's, I think, cheating. You should be a better team that you don't need to do it.
Yep. Well, it's cheating though. The batsman should stay behind the crease till the ball is let go. That's just the rules. I don't even know why it's a question. All right, we had another listener mail. This is from Graham at Twitter, GRAMY71, obviously an English fan, called me a convict and then said, Menas, you're such a cock on your podcast. So was not a fan of me saying Jimmy Anderson retired. That's what I'm getting from this message.
He's not wrong.
Speaking of that, how is Anderson going in his latest test match? I haven't heard. You said this would be his last test. Has he gone okay in this test,
Ben? He's done very well. He's got 6 wickets. As we record this, it's before the last day. So he sits on the edge of 600 test wickets. And, you know, if they don't get on because of rain, he might finish his career on 599 test wickets.
Well, they're 2 out, Pakistan. I would love it. No, nothing more if when this goes to air, Anderson has 14 wickets for the match. That'd be quite funny.
All right. That was our review of The Edge and viewer mail. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Oz Cricket Pod. That's AUS Cricket Pod. Or you can find us on TikTok as Cricket Unfiltered. We'll be back with Can't Let It Go. And we're coming to the end of this edition of Cricket Unfiltered. We started with Pete Lawler and the headlines. We've reviewed The Edge. Now it's Can't Let It Go. Jaleesa, what's your Can't Let It Go? Didn't Pete steal it?
Yeah, Pete stole it. No, he's not allowed back. No. Mine was, Lisa Stelaker. But I'll come up with another one on the spot. I'll just use this time to plug, if you've got KO, I'm... KO are not telling me to plug this, just to be clear. But if you've got KO, go back and watch the packages that were done during the rain delays and the bad light delays and everything. If you haven't seen them, which most people probably haven't because they sleep normally, unlike the rest of us. So go back and have a look at those packages because some of them are really good.
Okay, and I'll draw attention to the fact that your love of Shane Warne is well known on this podcast, and he actually he didn't reply to your tweet. He quote tweeted your tweet, which is the ultimate alpha move. But hey, you got to take what you can get when it's the king.
Yay, quote tweet, because I was tweeting exactly that I thought the coverage in between those delays has been outstanding, some of the best that I have ever seen, and he retweeted it. So, and he wasn't even tagged in it, so I don't know how he saw it, but
He was tagged in it.
Oh, was he? Not by me.
No, but by the original person. And when you replied, they all...
Love how Paul forensically analysed why he replied to Jaleesa's tweet.
No, I'm just good at Twitter. I'm good at things in life.
I'm not good at Twitter, so I'm good at tweeting. I'm not good at...
By the way, Jaleesa, could you reply to Warnie and ask if he could unblock me? That'd be great.
Why are you blocked? Oh, bury the lead. Here we go.
I think
not so polite, Paul.
All Twitter accounts.
Not so polite.
all Twitter accounts that were established between in the early years came pre-blocked by Warne. So that's why I'm blocked.
No, I don't think that's true. I do what not did think
you
do? That is
Tell
true.
Us what you did.
I don't know what I did. I didn't do it. I know of almost no one who's not blocked by Shane Warne. I think even Pete Lawler might be blocked by Shane Warne.
Is he really? I'll have to ask him. I'm not blocked by Warney.
Check. You might be by now.
Maybe I am now. Maybe after he hears this, I'm going to be blocked. I don't block people. Who blocks people?
You know, you can set on Twitter that you can block people who would just follow certain people. So if you follow Paul, you might get blocked automatically.
Oh, no, Paul, I might have to unfollow you. Sorry. Nothing personal.
The king wins again. All right. Paul, what's yours?
I have a new hero, umpire Michael Goff. He's just crept up on me. But the record that he's got this series, he's had only two decisions overturned. Forget exactly how many he's had challenged, something like 25 or 27. That is, even allowing for the fact that umpire's call gives them a slight leeway, that is remarkable. I mean, I love to watch the game pretending I'm the umpire and give my decision live. And I'm probably 50%, and I think I'm half decent at umpiring. So magnificent. And I just love it when an umpire is that good. And I'd be very happy for him to be umpiring the next Ashes, even though he's English. I think that he'd be a level up on what they had in their 2019 Ashes.
Paul can't let go of the excellent umpiring from...
I love the umpires getting a shout-out. People are so hard on umpires.
Okay, my can't let it go. It's a bit of a weird one, but I was listening to another cricket podcast by Jared Kimber, who's been on this show a few times, called the Red Inca podcast. And Jared had a guest on called Subhash Jayaraman, who started a cricket podcast in 2012 and he's done 199 episodes. And Jared Kimber kept calling him the podcast king. You're the podcast king. You're the podcast king. So obviously I got annoyed because I'm thinking you just can't throw that term around. So I sent a message to Subhash on Twitter. I said, enjoyed your podcast. Something like, enjoyed the podcast with the alleged podcast king. And he writes back going, well, what do you mean by that? Alleged, you know, it wasn't taking the joke at all. And then I just said, I thought the nickname was amusing. And he says, whatever makes you sleep at night, mate. So I was like, okay, the podcast king has no sense of humor at all. So I've been, you know, making friends as usual on Twitter.
Nice. You are so salty, Manners.
Well, Kim, I mean, if anyone's a podcast king, it's not some idiot that's done some terrible interviews. All right. So that is... The Can't Let It Go for this week.
Podcast King and I are not on Menna's good side.
Why, you're on my good side, Talisa.
All right. Funny. No, this has been like Jeff Horn and Zoo early.
You just don't know good TV. That's the issue.
Please.
All right, I think we should end this podcast before we all come to blows. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this episode of Cricket Unfiltered. Thank you to Peter Lawler from The Australian for joining us. Lots of cricket coming up, so I'm excited. Jaleesa, thanks for coming on. Go and watch Cricket Fever. I think you'll like that one a bit more. There's lots of footage of cricketers behind the scenes for you.
I like that. That's what I need.
Lots of dressing room talks. You'll love it.
Good.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us despite your lack of sleep due to cricket viewing.
Thanks, guys.
That's it for Cricket Unfiltered. Back next week.
Rugby League is back for 2020, and whether you're a new fan or a seasoned veteran of the NRL, why not check out NRL Boom Rookies? Hosted by Dale, Matt and Mitch, three friends who've worked in various off-field roles across the sport over the past few years. If you're after something a little bit different to They Just Wanted It More or The Boys Dug Deep, this podcast is what you've been looking for. With a healthy mixture of statistical analysis and insight, jokes, pop culture references and cross-sport tangents, regardless of your rugby league knowledge, NRL Boom Rookies will have something for you. That's NRL Boom Rookies, available on Acast.